Om Kataksha Kirana Chanta Naman Moha Hriye Namaha Anantananda Krishnaya Jagan Mangala Murtaye Ahamasmi Sada Bhami Kadachinna Hamapliha Brahmaiva Hamatasintam Sachidananda Lakshanam Mayevo Deti Chidvyomni Jagat Gantarva Patanam Atohan Nakatam Brahma Sarvadhyam Sarvakaranam Nasvatav Svatya Bhignanat Niram Shatwan Nachanyataha Nachashriya Vinashanme Vinashasya Anashriyat Nashoshaposha Vikleda Chedas Chinnabaso Mama Satyairapyani Lagnyambaha Shashvai Kimuta Kalpitaihi Abharupasya Vishwasya Bhanam Basanidhirvina Kadachinavakalpeta Bhajahantena Sarvagaha Nahi Bhanad Pratesatvam Narate Bhanam Chitochitaha Chitsam Pedo Pinadhyasa Rate Tenaham Advayaha. Okay, we'll do a little bit more on this. Who knows how much more? A few more things to say. We've been had this for two classes. We've been two full classes.
That's a good verse.
I guess we could spend a lifetime on this one.
The top line, you've got some different terms that are being used here that I want to make sure that we're clear. One is bhanam, then chit and achit, right? And then sattva existence. So when we say something is achit, it means it's not self-evident. In order for it to be known, it has to be illumined. Now, why I'm making that, emphasizing that, is that, in fact, there is, in reality, nothing that is achit. There's nothing that is, in reality, jada. Jada means inert. There's no such thing as an inert object. There is only consciousness. That's why when we say maya, the maya upadhi, there is no substance maya that is in competition with consciousness. Like we have consciousness, which is chit, and then we have achit, the unconscious, as though there's two different things. So that means we have to be very careful what we mean by achit. You know, it also doesn't mean unconscious, like conscious, mm-hmm. unconscious, because unconscious is kind of a Western term, like you're unconscious, so you're not conscious of that. It doesn't mean that. So achit means that which is itself is not self-evident. If it's not self-evident, for it to be known, it needs to be illumined. In other words, consciousness has to, as though, shine upon it. In fact, in the totality of what is, the only thing that is self-evident is consciousness per se. Anything that is illumined by consciousness, you know, that can be objectified, also anything that can be objectified, that thing itself is not self-evident, right? So that's what we mean by a chit. In other words, if it's not illumined by consciousness, it's not known. And so you can just take it very simply now. If I'm looking here in this direction, everything that I'm perceiving is objectified, right? I'm aware of it, and so it is shining. But it's only shining because of me, not because of itself, right? However, that isn't true. And I look this way, all of those things are gone. Now all of these things are shining, right? They become known, but they're only known because of my presence, not of their own accord. So there is, in fact, nothing in the creation which is known from its own standpoint. When we say it's known from its own, from itself, that's what we mean by self-evident, right? Self-evident. So the word for self-evident is svatasiddha. It's self-evident. Evident means it's self-established, self-evident is how we translate it. Swetaha means from itself. It's established in established by itself. So the translation Swetaha Siddha is self-evident. Another word we use is swaprakasha, self-shining. Swa is the self. It's self-shining. So all of these words Swetaha Siddha and swaprakasha, are used that can only words that can only be used for the self. Because here's swaprakasha, the prakasha, we could say the sun is self-shining, but the self, the sun is self-shining as light, and that's why it's a good example to use for the self. But the sun doesn't know itself, right? It's not consciousness, but it lights up everything. It's and doesn't need something else to come in and light it. So the sun is a really good example that we use for consciousness. But light is different than consciousness, right? And so, in fact, consciousness is required to be aware of light, right? So consciousness plus your mind plus your sense organs plus your eyes. In fact, if you're blind, for you it is totally irrelevant. If you're completely blind, it's totally irrelevant whether the lamp is on or not, right? Because there is no means of knowledge for illumining light. And light is not illumining itself from the standpoint of consciousness. Okay. So the only thing that's Swetaha Siddha and Swaprakasha is chit. Anything except that requires consciousness for it to be known. Okay. So that whole little talk there was just to differentiate what we mean, what's the difference between chit and achit. Not that there's another word is that we use is jada. Mm-hmm. Achit or jada. Jada translates as inert. And so then we have to be, what do we mean by inert? It's not a good translation.
It's interesting, these terms, because now I'm thinking achit and jada. These are just technical terms.
What?
These are really just technical terms, in a way, because they're tuchung. You know, achit and jada don't really exist, but technically they have their use to contrast.
They're used to contrast.
Yeah.
But then you have to explain what is meant by that, because a lot of the words that we use in language, even in Sanskrit language, are not just technical terms. They're also terms that are used, you know, just in what we call vivahara, empirical, layman's use. And so when we use a term like that, then you have to unfold the term. Right? And that's our situation here, including jada. You know?
So jada doesn't really mean inert. What does it mean?
Well, it can mean, it depends on how I'm talking. Like if I'm saying the chair is jada, but the human being is conscious, is not jada.
So are you using in that sense, are you calling it insentient?
And you can say if you're saying...
But you have to be careful about this.
Yes, what I'm trying to say, if you're within...
Ability to shine.
Exactly. But if you're within the creation, now here we are within the creation, this is jada, because it doesn't have a sukshma sharira, doesn't reflect consciousness, it doesn't talk to you, right? So these things are jada. And then the human beings and plants and animals do reflect consciousness. They have a subtle body, a sukshma sharira, and so they're considered sentient. So we have the sentient and the insentient within duality. But now, say we're talking about, we're going to a different level, and we say, ask a question, well, is this creation, this whole Maya Upadhi and everything in it, is it inert? Is there something which is inert?
No.
Does inertness really exist? Right? And then now we have to look at it from a different level, where we're looking at, so once you say Advaita, non-dual, there's no such thing as inert. But then what do we mean? Here's all of these inert things here.
Yeah.
So what do we mean when we use that term?
Yeah. So it's for analysis.
Yeah. You know, it's for analysis, right? But we're jumping levels. We're not talking, we're not differentiating objects in the creation. Differentiating objects in the creation, those things that have a sukshma sharira, enjoy consciousness. Those things that don't have a sukshma sharira, don't enjoy consciousness. So we have things that enjoy consciousness, things that don't enjoy consciousness. Okay? But now the question is, what where is the consciousness that these things enjoy? You know, then there's a whole unfoldment that goes on to show that the consciousness which that things that have a sukshma sharira enjoy and things that don't and have a sukshma sharira don't enjoy, that consciousness is the consciousness from which the whole creation comes. Okay. Then in this whole creation, what is the nature of this creation? Because in fact, the entire creation is objectified. I'm making a little jump here, but see if you can follow it. The entire creation is objectified, or we can say objectifiable, right? Including the things that, including the sukshma sharira, right? Including the physical body, objectifiable. The sense organs, objectifiable. The thoughts, the mind, objectifiable. The ahankara, objectifiable. So all of these things, in fact, are illumined by consciousness. They are not sweta siddha, right? And so because they're not themselves, from their own standpoint, able to shine, that they require consciousness in order for them to enjoy consciousness, they themselves are achit. And so what happens with this analysis, with this drisha viveka, when you recognize that it's not only inert things that can be objectified, the things that you have attributed consciousness to are also objectified. And in fact, the consciousness itself is the one that illumines it and is in fact free of it, because all of these things that are illumined are sometimes illumined, sometimes not illumined, sometimes known, sometimes not known. When they're not known, they're not knowing you back, saying, you know, hey, you're not knowing me right now. You know what I mean? They don't have the capacity. Any object in the world, including the sukshma sharira, which includes all of the sense organs and the vrittis, all of the four types of vrittis, the ahankara, everything, all of those things require consciousness, and you have a consciousness illumines them, and therefore they are known. They are known because they're illumined. They aren't known because they're self-shining. Okay.
With the water wave example, well, in my mind, because the wave doesn't shine without the water. You know, it's really just that satyam mithya.
Satyam mithya, the wave doesn't shine without the water, the wave also doesn't exist without the water.
Right.
Or both the sat chit. Right. Yeah. There's nothing there but water. That's right. That's good. Because from the standpoint of the... it's a little bit different, but from the standpoint of the wave, it has no being other than water. Well, that's true. Here in the Maya Upadhi, from the standpoint of the whole Maya Upadhi, it's not even here without consciousness. It has, without sat chit, it has no being. So to establish that, we have to go into an analysis of all of the names and forms within the creation to see that they are bordered by non-existence. Anything that changes is bordered by non-existence. Any object that's in the creation is infinitely divisible. You can't find anything here in the creation, but as you analyze it, the constant is the sat-chit. Right? You can't find an object here, but as you go on breaking down the objects into their component parts, which is kind of an infinite regress, you can never get to the bottom of it, what remains as the constant is the sat-chit. It is and it is known. Anything that comes into being and goes out of being, it is, and it is known before, during, and after. So the sat-chit is the constant of what is there, and you can't find anything out here. So that's kind of that type of logic. This logic is a little different, though all of these logics are revealing the same thing. You know, but in this logic, or in this thing, the idea now is to, what we're doing right now is defining what they mean, just to kind of rehash it, defining what they mean by achit. Because in the wave ocean, that's a good example for recognizing there's no such thing as achit. It doesn't exist, right? But we have to account for ourselves being here and this Maya Upadhi, where we experience the Maya, and experiencing the Maya in terms of this dual creation, you start out by recognizing that there are conscious beings in the creation and unconscious things in the creation, sentient things, insentient things. You start out that way and you say, I'm the sentient thing, and everything that I perceive is insentient. Then I'll say, but you're all like me, so even though I perceive you, I know that you're sentient, but I know that that these things are different from me. Now, the rogue is different from me, so I'll say it's insentient. So basically, anything that doesn't have a sukshma sharira is insentient, and anything that does have a sukshma sharira is sentient. Mm. That's ajnana. That's everybody's daily reality. But then what happens is, and what do we mean by insentient? It doesn't enjoy consciousness. This is just everybody's experience. It's insentient. It's achit. It doesn't enjoy consciousness. You know? It's not a conscious being. Then what happens is when we do the strict Risha Viveka, you recognize that the things you had even thought were chit, sukshma sharira, that they also are objectified, illumined. And that the consciousness which we give to them, in fact, is superimposed upon them. That's the adhyasa. When you say this body enjoys consciousness, well, not really. The body, you know, you can say because of the sukshma sharira, it reflects consciousness, but for instance, a dead body, well, body is there, but a dead body doesn't enjoy consciousness. You can also look at, then take, well, the body is inhabited by the sukshma sharira. The mind, you can say, the mind enjoys consciousness. Well, not really. Right? Because the mind itself is illumined, and the mind is, like everything else in the creation, subject to continual change, coming and going. And when a vritti comes and goes, if that vritti itself had consciousness, then the vritti would be self-evident. Say the vritti, the thought modification, it has consciousness. That's its swarupa, its nature. Then wherever that vritti goes, consciousness is. Right? That conscious vritti is, because its very nature is that the vritti itself, you know, sattva, enjoys consciousness. But that isn't the case. What happens is that when the vritti is there, it shines, banam. It shines, you know. But it doesn't shine without consciousness. It itself doesn't enjoy consciousness. What allows it, that banam, that to appear, to shine, is consciousness. It itself isn't shining of its own accord. And so what we realize is that even the things that reflect consciousness as though, the body, the mind, the sense organs, all of the vrittis, they reflect consciousness, they themselves don't have consciousness. So they join the ranks of achit. Right? That's why we use the example of holding a mirror and a rock up to the sun. Right? Both are equally achit. Neither one enjoys consciousness of its own, on its own. But one is like a sukshma sharira, the mirror, right? Mm-hmm. It seems to enjoy the consciousness. It enjoys the sun. The sun's there reflected in it. Because of the very material, the nature of the material. But the rock doesn't. Both are equally illumined, you know, both equally illumined by the sun, but one material doesn't reflect, the other does. That they use that example to show the difference here between what seems to enjoy consciousness and what seems not to enjoy consciousness. It depends on the material. So sattva, by its very nature, reflects consciousness in this creation. But when you do that analysis, we see that there is nothing in the creation that itself is consciousness, itself enjoys consciousness, that would make it, by its nature, chit. And so nothing enjoys that. Everything in the creation that is objectifiable is by its nature achit. Achit means it's not swetasiddha. It's not self-evident, self-shining, swaprakasha. It's not self-evident, self-shining. So now with this verse, it goes, nahi banat rate sattvam. Without bana, now bana means for something to can I use the word shine? Like, if we say consciousness is self-evident, right? It doesn't need anything to illumine it, it is there of its own accord. It's present by its own accord. Something which is a chit, like anything in the creation, is not present by its own accord, by itself. It requires for it to be known, to be known, consciousness. Without consciousness, it isn't known, it can't be known. Mm-hmm. It's not just that it isn't known, it cannot be known, because it's not self-shining. Do you see it? So for it to be known by anyone, even by Ishvara, it requires consciousness, because it doesn't have it itself. So that's why here they say the sattva, the existence of something, without bana, means without itself appearing, right? The sattva, there's no sattva for it, without itself shining, right? It has to shine, means it has to appear. But without it appearing, there's no existence for it, right? Means, let me put it, without it shining as though it is self-evident, you know, it's shining there, without that bana, without that appearance, then there is no sattva for it. It doesn't exist. It exists, but nobody, not even Ishvara, can know it. Okay? Because it's not self-evident. So in order for it to be, it requires consciousness. So it requires that appearance. It must appear. So then now it says, and that appearing, that bhanam, na rate, without chit, right? There is no bhanam of a chit, which is not self-evident, without consciousness. You see that? Na rate, that first rate goes with chit. Chitta has in the fifth case. So without a chit, without chit, na bhanam a chit. A chit's in the sixth case. The same, fifth and sixth mm-hmm. case. So without chit, mm-hmm. there is no bhanam of a chit. Right? Because a chit isn't self-evident. It requires consciousness. Okay? So far, so good?
Yeah, it's line two.
Okay. But if this is good, if this is clear, then this is we're doing good.
Okay.
Okay, now also, chit sambedha api. Now there's another problem. Sambeda means sambandha, connection. Also, a connection, a union, an association with chit is na adhyasat rate, without adhyasa, is not possible. Because what kind of sambandha or connection can there be between that which is self-evident, that which is self-shining consciousness, and anything else? Where is there a connection with that? So he says, without adhyasa, right, there can be no connection. In other words, this is getting us into the satyam mitya. Now, to understand, to have this line work, you have to understand the first line, mm-hmm. right? The first line is, first of all, there can't be any existence at all for something without it appearing, right? And it can't appear something that is a chit, right? Isn't self-evident, can't appear, it can't shine without consciousness. So it's totally dependent on consciousness. And so now, here we have this creation, which is a chit, you know, which is not self-evident, which is known only because of consciousness. It is and is known only because of consciousness. And so it depends totally on consciousness for its being, for its shining. So now what is the relationship between it and the consciousness?
Wow.
Okay. So you have to say, what is that relationship? The relationship has to be satya mitya. This whole thing has to depend upon the consciousness for it to be. Now, consciousness itself doesn't have a problem. From the standpoint of consciousness, there is no adhyasa. So when you use the word adhyasa, you have to go to within the creation, because the sentient beings within the creation, the humans within the creation, are the ones that have this problem. Because I will say, I am a conscious being. Right? So when I say, I am a conscious being, I am referring to what is a chit. Right? Because I'm the one that's going to say that. You know, the animals aren't going to say it, the plants aren't going to say it, the trees aren't going to, I mean, the, you know, the trees aren't going to say it, things aren't going to say it. So I'm the one that's going to say it. The human being, the Ajnani, is the one that's going to say, I am the conscious being. How can I say it? Because actually, this whole thing, the body, the mind, the sense organs, have nothing to do with consciousness in the sense that they are illumined by consciousness. Right? And so the subject-object, there's the consciousness that illumines this physical body, you know, has nothing to do with it. It's not illumining me back. Consciousness illumines the body, and the body doesn't, the body doesn't say hi back, you know. The mind, you illumine the mind. The mind is known. The mind doesn't turn around and know you back. There's not two conscious beings here. There's only one conscious being. And so this becomes dependent for its being, for its luminosity, upon the consciousness that illumines it, and yet it says, I am the conscious being. How can it say that? Only by means of adhyasa, right? Where what is itself achit, means mitya, you know, is identifying itself, the mitya is identifying itself with the consciousness. That's what it is. And since the mitya itself, what is appearing, has no existence without consciousness, that adhyasa, the adhyasa is causing it to assume the consciousness, right? The superimposition causes it to assume the consciousness to give the being that it is to itself, right? It's giving the being, the conscious being, which is its wave ocean, wave water self, to itself. That's what allows for there to be some sort of a sambandha or some type of relationship between consciousness and this body, mind, sense organs. In fact, there is no relationship. There is only conscious being, right? Which this body, mind, sense organs, the Maya Upadhi, enjoys, which allows it to be known, allows which is from its own standpoint, a chit, to be known. But from the standpoint of the Maya Upadhi, the body, mind, sense organs, it says, I am that. That's what we call adhyasa, that superimposition. But because that's an impossibility, they say, therefore, tena aham advayaha, I am non-dual. Right? Because the only thing that's allowing for this duplicity, this subject-object relationship as though, you know, is adhyasa. There is no object apart from that's not illumined by consciousness. Because if it's not itself self-evident, it's totally dependent on consciousness for its being. It has no being of itself because it's not self-evident. So it totally depends upon consciousness to illumine it. Right? And so therefore, if it says, I am the conscious being, how I am conscious, and this is inert, how can it say that? It can only say it because of adhyasa. So now we get into the satya mitya. Now, this has no being, no independent being, apart from sat-chit, which is itself self-luminous. Right? And so what does that mean? That means that I'm non-dual, because there isn't any, a chit itself doesn't have any reality or any being apart from consciousness. Is that okay?
And this non-dual, should we expect an experience of it, or non-dual? It always
the experience of it is not an objectifiable experience. It's swetha siddha. It's self-evident. You know, yeah. But that's
a non-dual.
You don't expect a new experience of it, but there's as though a new experience of it, because what we call the Dehatma Buddhi, The Dehatma Buddhi is the notion of the self being the body, which is this adhyasa. So Dehatma, Deha is body, Atma the self, Buddhi was notion or conviction. Mm-hmm. Conviction is better, the conviction of the self being the body. We all have that conviction. Okay. And so that means that we are a conscious being living in this inert creation. We don't look at the creation as being just consciousness, nothing but consciousness. That's another way of saying that. We don't look at this creation as being nothing but me. Because of that Dehatma Buddhi, nothing but me, the conscious being. But so we're so used to only experiencing the creation as a jiva within the creation, using our sense organs. So we are dual creatures. You know, anyone who has a body, is their whole body, mind, sense organs, is meant to participate within duality, even your hands and your feet, you know, and your voice. Everything about you is a product of duality. It's relational within the dual world. And because there's a sukshma sharira, a subtle body, you as a jiva, right, reflect consciousness differently than the chair, the things that don't have a sukshma sharira. And so you yourself have this relationship and a differentiation between yourself and inert things. I am conscious, this is not conscious, right?
Yeah.
And so your sense of self, this sense of self means the conscious being that you are, is totally identified with this body, mind, sense organs, because the space isn't talking back to me, the rug's not talking back to me. So there's a total adhyasa there. Right? And so you think of even consciousness. Consciousness is so also associated with knowership. Consciousness of. Not just consciousness, which is sat. Mm. Consciousness, which is being. You don't really think of it like that. Mm. But once you think of knowership, then you have your mind and your sense organs, and you're within the creation. So now what has to happen... And these are all of the different teaching methodologies that we use to make a person be able to appreciate this. And the first thing is this drik drisha viveka, where I have to recognize that in fact my being, the conscious being that I am, is actually the luminary, the consciousness, because of which the body, the mind, the sense organs, and the world is known. We have to differentiate it. Just recognizing that your mind, in fact, you know, a thought comes, is there, and it goes, and consciousness doesn't. Differentiating consciousness from the mind. And then the mind, you know, uses the sense organs. The sense organs depend upon the mind. And then because of the sense organs, the body is known. So we have to differentiate my being from all of these things that it has, this Dehatma Buddhi, such a conviction. That has to be differentiated, and then you have to recognize consciousness, your being in its own nature, just as consciousness, not consciousness of something. Okay? Mm-hmm. So once you recognize that, even now, once the differentiation is clear, the being that you are right now, your eyes are perceiving, your sense organs are functioning, your mind is thinking, all of these activities are going on, there's all this subject-object relationship going on right now, and there is you who is pervasive and central to all of that activity. And your own presence is not doing anything. The me. You say me. You know, knowing is going on. I am there. I am there present to the knowing that is going on, to the perceptions that are taking place, to the mind that is thinking. But I'm not doing anything. Say my mind is thinking away. I'm not thinking away. You know, my eyes are looking here and looking here. I'm not doing anything. I just simply am being. I have to recognize that being.
Yeah.
Now, when I recognize and differentiate that being through the drik drisha is one of the ways of helping me to just get to my own nature, then you say, okay, it's not just this room that is objectified by me, where I'm the subject and this is the object. In fact, this body belongs into this in this room. This body, physical body, is also part of the room known to me, right? Not only that, the very sense organs that are giving me the perception of this body, the functioning of the sense organs, you know, they are also known to me. They're known by the mind. And not only that, the mind itself, all of its thoughts and its moods and emotions and its perceptions, those are also known. So now what happens is that it's not just me as a jiva aware of the room through my sense organs. It's that the whole room, including the body, mind, sense organs, take place in my awareness. That's one way of breaking it down. Because these things also are all objectified. And so awareness now we're going to do it just a slightly different. All of these things are objectified, you know, that I have a subject-object relationship with, leaving me just as pure awareness. Now we're going to look at it a little differently. In fact, even your thinking that you know this physical room, what is actually happening is that because you have sense organs, I mean, you can't know the room without your sense organs, and because your mind is using your sense organs, you have, in fact, a vritti, a thought modification of the room, which includes your physical body and your sense organs and everything that is objectifiable that is in that vritti at any given moment. All of the totality of your objectified experience at the moment is contained in the vritti. Otherwise, you don't know it because it's not objectified. You know, it's just like all my sense organs are open and they should be functioning, but I'm daydreaming. I don't see any of this. But whatever is occupying the vritti, that's what's known. If it's a daydream or a thought or whatever I'm doing, that's what's known. So actually, we start out realizing, okay, and I'm an individual in this room. Then we realize, no, the body, mind, sense organs is also within this room. They're all objectifiable. And then we think, well, actually, that's all true. That's all true. All of this body, mind, sense organs, it does belong to the room, right? Because an object in the room. But actually, even the way that I know this room is really only through the vritti, okay? Now, the vritti of the room now includes my body, mind, sense organs, everything. This vritti is illumined, right? Any vritti you have, it is illumined, it is known, right? How is it known? It's not self-evident. It's known because of consciousness, right? It is, and it is known because of consciousness, any vritti. The vritti comes into being, into conscious being, and then it goes. When it is in conscious being, right, it is and it is known. But the isness and the knownness is conscious being, is me, not the vritti. The vritti is acit. It's not self-evident. Okay? So now, this vritti that includes the whole room and everyone in it, including my body, mind, and sense organs, is it partially or completely illumined by the sat-chit? It's not in the vritti, only your body is illumined. In the vritti, whatever is in the vritti is equally illumined. It doesn't have more consciousness on the right side than on the left side, right? The entire vritti enjoys sat-chit, right? So another way of saying that is, in fact, I am the self. I am the sat-chit of the entire vritti, right? Not just of any given part in the vritti. So now, so far so good? Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to say, if I were to just ask you to imagine a meadow. Now you imagine the meadow, my meadow that I'd like you to imagine. You imagine the meadow, and now if I tell you, do you see, this is, now we have a meadow vritti. As opposed to a room vritti, we have a meadow vritti. Now, if I say to you, that vritti, you are the self of that vritti, that's probably easy to understand. In other words, there's no part of the meadow that doesn't enjoy your being and your consciousness. Even all the living creatures in the meadow, you know, the humans in the meadow, the plants, the trees in the meadow, and the stones and the rocks, those are also equally part of the meadow. The whole thing enjoys you. You are the self of the entire meadow of vritti, right? Now, vritti is vritti. Whether it's vritti of a meadow that you're imagining or a vritti which is a perception, vritti is vritti. Now, when you have the... Now, this is what makes this so important, is that when I ask you to imagine the meadow, you don't have a dehatma buddhi with any part of the meadow. Even if I ask you to take a body in the meadow, just enter the meadow and engage in a relationship with all of the people and the birds and everything in the meadow. So you go and take a body in there and walk through the meadow, you still, any dehatma buddhi you have is bodhita. Bodhita means it's not real to you. You know what it is.
But it's still there.
It's still there. Still there. But there's nobody in you that says, that is me.
Yeah, okay.
You are still, even though you've taken a form in the meadow, it's still a vritti. You're still the self of the meadow. You're the satchit of the meadow. There's no problem.
Okay.
Okay. But now remember, this meadow is a vritti. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now we have another vritti. The vritti is the vritti of this room. But in this room is this body, mind, sense organs, for which has, you know, a conviction, a very serious conviction, called the dehatma buddhi.
Uh-oh.
It's a very, very serious conviction. And so if I ask you now to just you recognize, okay, how I know this room is through vritti, because of the sense perception, you know, the whole thing takes place because of my sense perception, and it is known because there's a vritti now that's been generated. And so now I say, well, this, do you see that you are the self of this entire vritti? Do you recognize that, in fact, you are the sat-chit of this vritti, that your being pervades the whole vritti, is this, and that the conscious being that you are is the self of this whole vritti? That is harder. It's harder because of the dehatma buddhi. Whereas, in fact, there is no difference. Vritti is vritti. You know? So if you can recognize the pervasiveness of sat-chit in the meadow, you can recognize the pervasiveness of sat-chit of your being in vyavahara. You know, just from a subjective standpoint, from you as somebody walking through, you can recognize that, because all of your experience, no experience that you have is away from vritti, from a vritti. If you don't have the vritti there, you're not having the experience. There's no possibility of the vritti not enjoying the sat-chit, which is you. And so it's good to go from the meadow to the room, from the meadow to the room, to try to see, to try to recognize that there is nothing in your experience that is away from you. You know, you're the self of the totality of your experience. If you can do it for the meadow, you can do it for this. Then other prakriyas have to deal with the reality of this vyavahara of which I am a part. The body, mind, sense organs are a part. Whereas we don't really need prakriyas to use prakriyas, teaching methodologies in reference to the meadow and you as an individual in the meadow, because it's very clear that the individuals in the meadow are the same order of reality as everything else in the meadow. Right? That dehatma buddhi isn't there. But that's why we can use the meadow as a prakriya for understanding this situation. And why we can do that is because a vritti is a vritti. Right? The relationship between sat-chit and the vritti is exactly the same as the relationship... The meadow vritti is exactly the same as the relationship between sat-chit and the perception. You know? But then we have to look at again, the reality of this perception, because the one who's having a problem is the jiva within this creation. In the meadow, I'm Ishwara.
Okay, you know, I have one little question here. This Dehatma Buddhi, it doesn't exactly go away, but I know that it's not true. I mean, I still feel like I'm in the body.
It becomes what we call bodhita. Bodhita means that the it remains without it remains with knowledge rather than ajnanam. In other words, like when you gain knowledge, you don't lose the body. You gain self-knowledge, you don't lose the body until the prarabdha is over. You don't lose the sukshma sharira until the prarabdha is over. And therefore, this body will continue to enjoy consciousness, so will the mind and the sense organs. And so the body will continue to have a sense of self. But the self has been differentiated from the body, mind, sense organs. That's the satya mitya. So you recognize this body, mind, sense organs enjoys me completely, like the pot enjoys the clay, but you've realized your own independence from those things which enjoy it, from those things which are upadis.
So that voice would still be there, that I am the body.
Only, if you were to say, you know, I am the body, or I am Edward.
Yeah.
Right? You're talking from the standpoint of the upadi.
Yeah.
But you, in your mind, you're not going to, well, you know, I joke about this all the time, you're not going to walk around saying, I am Edward, but not really.
Well, I do.
So, you need to know the whole thing. In fact, Edward, the body, mind, sense organs, is the self, but the self is free of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what is recognized. And not just hypothetically, or not as a theory. Because yourself is the only thing that is self-evident. It is self-evident. And since it's self-evident, it is there to be known, means the ajnanam that has caused, the ignorance that has caused the adhyasa, is something that is removed.
Yeah, because I'm concerned about this serious conviction, you know.
It's a serious conviction. You can see how serious it is, because beginningless births, all of which have held this conviction. You know, but that's why teaching, and it's also why it's not Shaktipat or anything. You know, it's something the mind has to recognize it thoroughly.
By knowledge.
Knowledge, yeah. Yeah.
Carol, can you say more about the limited versus the totality, in the sense that if I can sort of dissociate, you know, I'm not the body, I'm not the senses, I'm not the mind, I am consciousness superimposed on that, that's still me as like a focal viewpoint or locus of awareness that is not equal to all of.
Oh, yeah. There's a couple of things here.
Hi, Kibby.
First of all, awareness, the satchit, has no size. Size and dimension belong to the creation, right? Like if I ask you to imagine a meadow, you don't all of a sudden have to stretch out to become the meadow. But the meadow takes place in consciousness, which is really the only thing that is. You know, but doesn't have any duality for it to be big or small. These words don't apply.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now, when you are differentiating, say we do the drigdrisha, and you differentiate your being from what can be objectified. And there's two things here. First of all, there's that differentiation. Means that when you do that differentiation, what you recognize is that my being itself is free from, is not bound by what is objectified.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I recognize.
Okay.
But there's another thing I need to, just now, just from the standpoint of the jiva, another thing I have to recognize that has to be included in the drisha as we move through it. First of all, I'm not bound by the body, mind, sense organs, but if we go to the satya mitya, the body mind, sense organs enjoy me. Like the body can say, I am a conscious being. There's no second consciousness there, right? It's just that the consciousness that it is enjoying, it's enjoying through adyasa, because the body itself isn't self-evident. Consciousness is self-evident. Mm-hmm. So the body enjoys consciousness, the mind enjoys consciousness, the ahankara, everything enjoys consciousness. But the consciousness itself is not contained by the body, mind, sense organs. Okay?
Right.
If the consciousness is, and remember, consciousness is not big or small, but it's just not contained. Now, if it's not contained, then it isn't limited by the body, mind, sense organs, because it's not contained, and it's self-evident, it's not contained. So now, what is the difference between the uncontained me, self, that you are, and the uncontained self that I am? What would make us two?
Technically, there can't be a difference. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's just like the wave saying, okay, I realize I'm water, but I don't feel like I'm the whole ocean, I'm just one wave.
Well, this is very important. You, the body, mind, sense organs, are not the whole ocean. The wave is not the whole ocean. The wave is part of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, for you, as a body, mind, sense organs, you are a limited place in the creation, limited time, limited experience. But time, place, experience all exist within the creation. They have nothing to do with consciousness, which illumines, it's a luminary or the sat-chit of the creation. Consciousness itself has no size, it's not big, it's not small. You know, if you imagine a meadow, you're the Ishwara of the meadow, right? The whole meadow takes place in consciousness, as do all the little beings within the meadow. There's only one consciousness. The beings, each being doesn't have its own consciousness. Each being enjoys the one consciousness from which the whole meadow has come. So for you, from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, yes, you are limited, a part of the whole. You're part of Ishwara. But what about from the self, yourself? The self that is not contained by the body, mind, sense organs. If it's not contained by your body, mind, sense organs, it's not contained.
So it has to be the same self as yourself and everybody else's self.
And Ishwara's self. Because it's not contained.
Yeah.
Nor is it objectified. And so you are the one, your consciousness, the sat-chit that you are, is the one from which the entire creation comes. But now you are a jiva. The body, mind, sense organs are a jiva from in the whole. You're not Ishwara.
Yeah.
Your body, mind, sense organs are not Ishwara. You're part of Ishwara. But from the standpoint of the self, you are Ishwara. Right? But not from the standpoint of the whole Maya Upadi. Then you would have Ishwara's experience, the experience of the whole. We don't have, as a jiva, we don't have the experience of the whole. Just like in the meadow imagination, you are the Ishwara. You have the experience of the whole meadow and everything in it. But the individuals you bring into the meadow that are part there, they're not Ishwara, right? They are jivas within the meadow. But we would say, oh, jiva, you are Ishwara. That's the Tattvamasi. You are Ishwara. What does that mean? The jiva's not Ishwara. It's only part of Ishwara. It's only part of the meadow. But in fact, the self of the jiva is the self of Ishwara. So the conscious being that you are is Ishwara. It's because Ishwara is not going to say, I'm the Maya Upadi. Right? Ishwara is Brahman. But Brahman is not separate from the Maya Upadi. It's not Brahman and the Maya Upadi. It's not clay and the pot. From the standpoint of clay, there's only clay there. From the standpoint of Brahman, there's only Brahman there. Right? But the Maya is not something that has any type of being or reality other than Brahman.
But you know, it's kind of strange that that you have expectations that it's going to be something bigger than what I am.
No, that's not exactly true. What happens is that the mind itself needs to be released of its pain and its complexes and the emotional experiences that cause it to feel limited and small and all of these things, you know. And those experiences go slowly. You have to slowly work through all the complexes and all the pains that cause me to feel like a jiva. I remember when I was first in India with Swamiji, and I was at the course, and we were about 2 or 3 months into it, and the knowledge was so powerful, and I was getting it on, really getting it on different levels. And but then, of course, I had my little psyche to deal with, too. And so I just, you know, was gaining so much clarity, and at the same time, a lot of things were being stirred up. And I remember one day just sitting on my little bed in my room there and crying my eyes out. And I still remember just sobbing, tears running, my face was all wet and everything, boohooing and cry. And I remember clearly, I can still hear it, my saying, "What Brahman, who cares?" You know, because there's pain. There's pain in my mind, you know. And so this knowledge, you know, this knowledge actually goes underneath all of that pain, and it holds it. But you have to learn how to be with the unconscious and with the mind, you know, to help it to work through all of those things, because you don't want the mind to have those feelings of limitations that are caused by, you know, various complexes and upbringings and all of those things. So there comes a time when those complexes have gone, and or have been worked through enough to be maybe a nuisance in some ways, but not something that is really hurting you.
Overwhelming.
And so then those things aren't very... They're Maya. They're just what they are. It's like an irritating person or something. You know, or I mean, something that... not something... You know how to be with them. Mm-hmm. Or say if a little child... You don't view take care of a little child as though it's an irritating person. So I mean, that, why not? But your mind knows how to take care of these things, just like you. It's called Kaushalam. You know how to behave in the world and deal with difficulties in the world. It doesn't overwhelm your being. You know, but initially there's overwhelms there, and there's pain and things that need to be worked through. There comes a time when those things are all, as those things are there and being worked through, they're worked through, blessed by you. In other words, your being isn't covered by them, or lost, as though lost.
So you don't feel trapped anymore.
Yeah, you don't feel trapped. Even though there might be things in your mind you want to work on. You know, because they cause pain, or discomfort, or isolation, or these kind of feelings, you know. Those are things that are sadhanas, things to work on. But they don't have the capacity to take away your own presence as though. So in terms of, you know, there's no such feeling once the identification with problems in the mind is, you've gotten to a place where those are things that are just taken care of and handled. There is no such feeling that there's something that more about yourself that you should be experiencing. There should be a grander, there should be a bigger, better, grander, you know, experience. And that isn't true. Mm. That feeling wouldn't be there.
That's good.
Can you describe the state of one who has jnana? You know, who has that pure mind? What is their life like? What goes through their mind? What is their...
Well, I think I like the way Swamiji talks about it.
How do they walk?
How do they walk and how do they talk?
Yes.
How do they boogie?
How do they walk?
I think one of the main things is that you don't lose your objectivity. And you'll notice as your mind goes on, mature, you don't lose your objectivity. It's not that the world changes or that, you know, problems go away or anything like that. There are lots of problems all the way through life, and that's part of life. But this, that you don't lose the objectivity. You know, you don't get swallowed by the problem. You can deal objectively with the problem. And by objective, I don't mean cold. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with being cold or distant or looking at the problem from afar. Nothing like that. It's just that there's this, this is the situation, this is the problem, you know, and what is the best way to deal with it. There's no one getting overwhelmed by it. So there's a certain, I don't know, there's, I think there's a lot of things involved in that, like the natural vairagya that comes the more and more you enjoy just the nature of your own being. The mind doesn't want to make a big fuss out about things. It's not worth it. You know, it's much better to just deal with the situation without making a fuss.
Yeah.
Or getting into this thing, well, why me, and why did this happen to me, and, you know, look at how you're doing this to me and causing all these problems.
Why does that urge seem to be there? You know, that there is that.
Because you're still really depending on the world to be a certain way so that you can be happy.
Yeah.
But see, once you really start more and more to see that really what gives you this happiness within the world, you know, is being objective, because then your mind has shanti. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the clear water bucket reflecting the sun. The mind itself enjoys the ananda in spite of the situation.
Yeah.
You know, because you're not asking the situation to be in a certain way so that you can be happy.
It's not touching anything.
Well, in a sense, when you're, I'd say more like this, when you're not asking it to be in this way so that I can be happy, then the mind is free to be with the situation as it is without getting upset. Right. You get upset because if this situation is going to be like that, I'm going to be miserable. You know? But what if you don't do that? What if you've kind of realized through trial and error and through being burnt by fire and all of these things that we say, you know, all the monkey in the monkey's hand in the pot, you realize it's just not worth it, that your ananda really has nothing to do with any of that anyway. The peace of mind is when the mind just relies on the real source of its ananda, which is you. And so relying on that, you just accept this as Ishwara. And Ishwara, it is just Ishwara. And Ishwara, the prarabdha, I mean, your little piece, you know, is not an easy. Life isn't easy. It's 50-50, punya and papa. It's not as though you have this life. And even people will think, this life was really hard, but now that I have knowledge, you know, everything will change.
My credit rating.
Everything will, you know. Mm-hmm. Bhagavan will say, you have knowledge. You're such a special person.
Let me reward you.
Let me reward you from now on. All your papas are over.
Yes.
Right. Now they clean the slate. It's only Swargaloka.
Where'd that notion come from? I mean, you know. You figure that if you do all this work, you gotta get a reward. You know?
Well, you get a huge reward.
Yeah, but I mean, aside from that.
But what if I answered that? I would answer like this.
Yeah.
When you take this birth, like in Panchadashi, that Vidyaranya says this. It's too late. You know, you should have thought about that last birth. this birth is 50-50.
Yeah.
The prarabdha is going to take you all the way through. Now, it's in this birth that you decide to get knowledge. Not decide, but, you get knowledge halfway through. Well, you've got half of your prarabdha still to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the prarabdha is a result of the last birth and births. So Vidyaranya says, sorry, it's too late. You should have thought of that last life. But you didn't. So now you just have to, you have to go through the whole prarabdha and be a good sport about it, basically.
Okay, okay.
This is it. Except this is Ishwara. You know? And, I mean, it is... That is very plausible and fine and wonderful, but it only works in any type of real way when you recognize that the source of what you're seeking is the very nature of the seeker, then you can accept all of the things that go on in this creation, all of the karmas, your karmas and the collective karma, everything that's going on. It's a really rocky ride right now for the whole world.
Yeah.
It's the unfoldment of the collective karma and each one of our individual karmas. This is what's playing out right now. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we have to deal with it objectively, you know, and do our best. Like Swamiji says, I do my best with what's in front of me every day. I just do my best. And what's in front of you, there's always something to be done, right? It's not as though you're not already enveloped totally in your prarabdha. And your prarabdha is creating situation after situation after situation. So you say, well, I think I want a different prarabdha.
That arrow has already left the bow.
Yes, yeah,
right.
That arrow has left the bow.
There's no trading.
I think I want her prarabdha. I want his prarabdha. Let me just scoot over there. But nobody goes along with it.
No one wants to trade.
Nobody. You can't do it.
The good part of life is that person.
Yeah, exactly. I'll take the good part of her problem. So, and you really, I think you start to get very comfortable and accepting of your prarabdha. I mean, the infinite lives, this prarabdha is this prarabdha. You know, and it's yours. It's the one thing you can count on. You have a place in this creation, and this is it. You do have a place in the creation, and you have every right to be here. You are part of the whole, right? And nobody can take away your prarabdha, and also you can't take on anybody else's, which it also is, if that really is contemplated on and understood, that's also a big relief. If it's in your prarabdha, it will come to you. And if it's not, it won't. So don't worry about it. Within your prarabdha, you can do a lot of things, but most of it is attitudinal. Mm-hmm. In terms of making your prarabdha better, that has more to do with attitude than anything else. Because the way you are, way you face and are within your prarabdha changes the tone of it. Mm-hmm. If I'm like, say, I'm grumpy and crabby and hate everybody, because, you know, then here I am within the prarabdha, casting my negative light on it, and, you know, like Jung says, you know, the creation, you know, gives back, it gives you the face that you give it. It's really, I mean, that's an amazing thing. So you start, the attitude with which you're experiencing your, I mean, you have some control over it, makes it better. Not necessarily gets you out of the situation, but it does change the feeling tone of the situation dramatically, actually. So I'm just often said, you know, the most free will, the most free will is in prayer. Mm-hmm. You know, prayer and attitude. Because you can't, what can you really do in the prarabdha? You have free will within the prarabdha, but where you really affect the prarabdha is in your attitude, how you are with it.
What does the rudram do for us?
Rudram is considered maybe one of the most or the most auspicious prayer in the Vedas for antakarana shuddhi. It's a sannyasi. People in general in India will chant rudram if they're held within the Vedic culture, but especially sannyasis, you know, because when you're chanting rudram, you can't but see everything as Ishwara. That's what it is.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's recognizing Ishwara, it's recognizing the Punya Papa with the arrows that can be either the bow and arrow that can either protect you or pierce you. You know, the Papa, the Punya and the Papa, and then seeing you are this and you are this and you are this and you are this, you know, and you're the Antaryami of all of the things that I see. And so as you chant Rudram, if you chant it every day and you know what you're chanting, and you do that with devotion, to where you're actually seeing what you're chanting, you are recognizing Ishvara. So it's just considered to be very, very sacred in that way. And it's always Namaha, that always surrender to Ishvara. When you say Namaha, that's a, you know, I surrender to you who are in this form. So, yeah, something very auspicious about chanting it. I did it every day for many years. Then for some reason I stopped and I had to start up again. But you need to, you need to memorize it too.
Why do you want to start up again?
Because I do. Mm. I just do. I like to chant. I like chanting. Mm. Mm. It also is very, I don't know, chanting is, there's something very sacred about it. For what it does to the mind. Mm. It's, especially say if you're chanting something like Rudra, but you chant, it takes 5 to 7 minutes to chant. In fact, I used to chant Rudra, Durga Suttam, and Medha Suttam. I chanted, and Lakshmi, and Sri Suttam. I chanted all of those. It took too long. I couldn't keep it up. I did it for many years, and then I didn't want to do it anymore because I felt like I was getting, like I had to do it. That happens to me. Like if I start something, then I have to do it. And then I started feeling bound by having to do it. And then that was irritating me. And I said, you don't have to do it. And now I'm hoping I can start chanting again without getting into that. I get into that type of a thing. I start something and then I have to do it. So, I don't know, it's interesting. I know I'm not alone in that because other people have talked about it.
Yeah.
There's something about Rudra that's curious because the embracing of all of that differentiation, what keeps coming to mind is a story you've told about the two sadhus who are sitting there and they say, one of them says, this is it, there is nothing else. Somehow how, it's almost paradoxical, embracing all the variety, the mind can resolve into that sense of this is it, there is
nothing else. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you keep appreciating it. This is it. Yeah, that's a good day. I'll find that and show you that little cartoon.
Yeah, there's nothing more. Yeah. The old guy turns to the young guy, there's nothing more. Okay.
I had a little experience of objectivity this morning. I couldn't find my credit card, and I looked in different places around the house, in different coat pockets, and then I thought, well, I'll look in the car. But in the meantime, I was kind of upset, and then I thought, well, I'll either find it or I won't find it. And if I don't find it, I'll report it, and, you know, the usual steps. So I kind of calmed down. And then when I went to my car, I moved the car pillows, and there it was. And that was just so amazing. But I don't know, my mind calmed down after I thought, okay, I can handle this.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah, yeah.
Good for you.
That's a good example.
Happy to find it.
Should we do a little prayer? Or?
I did.
Should we do Purnima Dathmi?
Yes.
Okay.
Om Purnima Dath Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.